Okay. So let's say the prayer and think of the meaning of the prayer of taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. Sometimes we do it in English and Tibetan. This time let's do it in English one time and then Tibetan one time and then English again. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, the highest assembly, due to the merits of listening to the teachings and so forth. May I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye Chudang Soki Chognam La Jangchu Bardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Chishegi Pe Sonam Ki Grola Penchi Sangye Drupasho. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. Due to the merits of listening to the teachings and so forth, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. So try to meditate on the meaning of that for some time. As Rinpoche's mentioned in some detail, again and again, the causes of refuge, some deep fear, concern about our lowest level, where we may be reborn in next life, or in a deeper level of refuge, concern about fear, trepidation of, again, continuing in cyclic existence. And even as a Mahayana refuge, fear that we're unable at present to benefit sentient beings due to our delusions and so forth. And having confidence in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as actual sources of protection, of refuge from that. See if you can generate that mind. I think in terms of actually what decision you make from that, in a sense you're thinking, now I'm going to, taking refuge, committing myself to rely on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The main thing I rely on is the Dharma. So I'm going to seek, when I get confused, when I'm overcome by attachment or anger or confusion, rather than following my ordinary mind, to seek guidance from the Dharma, the teachings that I've learned, whether it be impermanence or the nature of suffering, the antidotes to the various delusions, the development of good heart, understanding of emptiness and so forth, impermanence. Thinking, even if we have not developed all of the factors yet to really feel warm heart, warmth toward all sentient beings, try to cultivate something similar to that now, looking at them with a pleasant sense. They've all been our best friends, as we may have best friends this lifetime. They've all been our moms, our dads, numberless times. And they're exactly like us in wanting to be free of suffering, wanting to be happy. So the sense of fear that we have for our own welfare is exactly similar to what we should have for their welfare. Same kind of fear that unless we can guide them, that they're going to experience suffering, not having the same resources that we have, not having met the Mahayana friend teachings, not having the incredible resources we have right now. To really benefit them, it's not enough just to be clever, educated, or sweet, kind, to know how to cure diseases or how to dispense funds. But we need to be able to have the medicine of Dharma to know what to dispense to know its power, to have experienced the Dharma ourselves. So we have to become Buddhas. We have to become enlightened. To do that, we have to purify, as it said, our Buddha potential. The stains on our mind, to help to eliminate those. So seeing that as the task at hand, that's what we have to be doing, to purify our Buddha potential, to become Buddhas. This means everyday life, watching our mind, overcoming our delusions, seeking the antidotes, purifying negative karma, accumulating virtuous karma, and so forth. So amongst the various actions that we can do to accumulate merit and wisdom, listening to the teachings are particularly powerful actions to do to accumulate merit like that. So with this virtuous motivation, think, I'm going to listen to the teachings for that purpose. Not just for some short-term aim of eliminating doubts in my mind that might be vexing, or to have cocktail party conversation that I can talk about, but to really seek the nectar of the Dharma, the medicine of the Dharma, to purify my Buddha potential, to become a source of happiness and welfare for all living beings, to become Buddha. Family here. Who are we missing? Beth Ann. All the Chunan Lai and her mom and Chu Mei, right? Her name Chu Sang. And Chin Yu. Right. I remember you telling us. So, you all know what we've been studying in Rinpoche since the last time we had a discussion group. Rinpoche's given two more discourses, the final two discourses, in this kind of introduction to the text, the Uttara Tantra. And those of you who want to continue studying, we'll try to continue with some more units of it later on that can fulfill, so that those that want to take the course in a sense for the basic program can fulfill the requirements of knowing about the text. So let me open up, first of all, if you have any questions, and I'll get to Sophia's question in a minute. Sophia wrote a question down. But anyone have anything pressing that they wanted to ask? It's Oma, Darlene.
When talking about the Buddha's potential, and it goes to technically to ignorance, violence, outburst the legacy of ignorance, and eliminating those. And then talking about the object of abandonment, of the hemidolic trap, object of abandonment, you know, the hemidolic trap of meditation, the object of abandonment of the seven spirit grounds, the object of abandonment of the three pure grounds. And it sounds like, would it say, obscures the golden image of the Buddha? Did he get to that?
No.
Oh, okay.
the example. There are nine similes in the section. First, Rinpoche hasn't even gotten to the extensive explanation of the definition of the precious gems, the three jewels, which is one of the main topics of the first chapter. And then later in the chapter, when it talks about the fourth vajra-like point, the potential, it talks about nine similes, and this example that you're referring to about that Maitreya mentioned, perhaps it comes in the sutra also, I can't remember the context. Maybe it comes in the sutra that Maitreya was referring to, this example, that we all have like a golden statue that's been sort of unrecognized because it's covered with impurities and clay. We all have this Buddha within us. We understand that to refer to not a fully enlightened Buddha because of the contradictions involved in accepting that kind of idea. That we're already Buddha, but we don't know it. But it refers to the potential. But we haven't got that far. This book is called India, the text that still exists, and maybe translated into Chinese also, it's called Ratnagotra Vibhanga. We call it Uttara Tantra, right? Ratna, you know what Ratna means. Do you know, Venerable? Pardon?
Jewel,
that, like the three jewels, the three gems, right? Ratna, precious things. Gotra is a Sanskrit word that means lineage, so it's referring to the Buddha potential, the Buddha lineage. Vibhanga means analysis. So the whole text that people have found in India, the original Sanskrit text that the Tibetan was translated from, basically is just being called from the main topics of this first chapter, because Ratnagotra involves the first four Vajra points, right? Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the Ratnas. And Gotra means the potential. Gotra means lineage or family. So if you ever run across, if you're trying to do some more research on this text and you read some of these translations from the Sanskrit, or if they're referred to, you'll know, oh, I know, that's the same text, that's Uttara Tantra, that's how it was, that's how the texts that have come down to the present in Sanskrit are labeled, the title, almost as though they've been relabeled with a shorter title. Okay. So, anyone else have a question? Venerable, I know you had a whole bunch of questions, but maybe you've been solving them all week. No? Venerable.
The knowing observation stages.
You don't know what those are, do you?
I still don't understand it. Now we've got two kinds.
I was making a joke.
The one that is mine and the one that isn't. Before I was heard that the shadup is in the category of dhenanduccha, which is not consciousness and not matter.
Okay, so let's give a little background first, because some people were. Did everyone follow, or did everyone not follow, or did? Okay, Victoria, how did you follow what was going on when he talked about that? What's your name, Becca?
Sigrid.
Did you follow? No. Did you follow, Chulin? Okay, Roberto.
What's the question?
When the last class. When there was some discussion about, in Tibetan, what we call shadrip, and is sometimes translated as the obstruction to omniscience, or the obstructions to knowing, or knowledge obstacle, they're all translations of the same term, jnana avarana in Sanskrit, I think. Do you remember the questions at the end of the class and so forth, what Rinpoche was talking about? Was that clear to you?
I've got over reformulated the question, and with a variety of answers, and I'm trying to come to the fact that there can be an obscuration.
No. Pardon?
That question I want to ask.
Okay, no. I'm just trying to get some info from you whether you understood or not. So I don't know if everyone needs a little background. Maybe it's worth to go back a little bit. Just to review, you've heard this before from what Rinpoche said. The work in one way of saying that we have to do is a good way of saying it, is to purify our Buddha potential. One of the ways of thinking about that is that we have to remove certain obstacles from our mind that are not found in the mind of an arhat, and then other obstacles yet that are not found in the mind of a Buddha, right? The obstacles that we have to eliminate to achieve the state of arhatship, which is the same as saying that we achieve nirvana, those obstacles are called the... Do you know what they're called? Who can say?
Holes. Would those be developmental obstacles?
No.
Okay.
Shumen numas.
Are those
the
afflictive
obscurations? Those are sometimes called, so the different things, you could call them afflictive obscurations or deluded obscurations. They are a synonym of that, not a different translation of the same word, but it's also called obscurations to liberation. So, what constitutes? Do you know, Chusang? What are the obstructions to liberation, or the so-called afflictive obstructions or obstacles? Yes, be specific. Don't be too spacey in general. More specifically. No, if you were asked by someone what are the obstructions to liberation, you would say they are the afflictions, the delusions. How many delusions are there? Well, there's 84,000 in one count, but when we talk about the 51 mental factors, we talk about six root delusions and how many secondary? 20 secondary delusions. I don't know if you've studied that. Well, those of you who are going to study low-rig mind and mental factors with us this coming year, you'll become experts on those. I'm actually an expert in the delusions. Not from study, but from just sort of innate experience. I've practiced them over numberless lives. So that's one part of the obstructions to liberation, also called, another name called the afflictive, as you said, afflictive or deluded obscurations. The other part is their seeds. Because even at this moment, if you look at Thupten Pemmo right now, she looks very calm. She doesn't have manifest in her mind right now attachment, pride, anger. But that doesn't mean that they are completely eliminated from her mind stream, because there's still, within our mind streams, there's still seed. When we meet the right condition, if she meets a nice chocolate eclair, the object, with the seed present in her mind, I'm not just talking about her, especially me, seeing that, that mind can be manifest. So when we talk about the obstructions to liberation or the afflictive obscurations, it's not just the delusions themselves, but the seeds, they're so-called seeds, like Christ said, that you reap what you sow. This idea of seeds in karma, that agricultural kind of idea, makes a lot of sense. Also in terms of the continuity of the delusions, what causes the continuity of delusion when it's present is the previous moment of the delusion, right? When one moment of anger acts as the source of the next moment of anger, sort of the substantial cause of that. But when the delusion's not there, what causes it to rise later? You know, it's not just the chocolate eclair, because if you hand the chocolate eclair to Kriti Senchab Rinpoche or to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, their attachment doesn't rise in their mind. So it's because there is another source of the afflictions, not just the continuity of the afflictions being present, but their seeds, which are kind of a latency, but they're given a different name. They're different kinds of latencies in our mind, or like the smell of garlic, remember Rinpoche was talking about? So these seeds are like the same things that are called, later are called imprints, except they have slightly different quality. These are what are responsible for giving rise to the delusions. On the path of seeing, when a person becomes an arya and they realize emptiness directly, certain of the delusions, certain of the afflictions, and certain of their seeds, well, the seeds of those particular delusions, are abandoned. So not only do you abandon the delusions, but you abandon the seeds, the delusions along with their seeds. And then further along on the path of meditation, on the various bhumis, if you talk about the bodhisattva path, or on the path of meditation, if you just talk about the hearers or solitary realizers path, further of those delusions, subtler, other varieties are abandoned along with their seeds. So those constitute the obstructions to liberation or the afflicted obscuration. So now if I asked you the next time, and would you have to say, would you be able to say what the afflicted obscuration? Now if I asked you, what are the afflicted obscurations? I'm putting her on her spot because mom and two sisters are here. So you'd have to say they're the afflictions and their seeds. Those are the, in fact, if you can abandon the afflictions, all the afflictions and their seeds, you will attain liberation. And one way of killing the affliction, eliminating the afflictions and their seeds, is getting down like a tree that's growing. If you get down to the root, if you can cut the root, all the life force is gone from all those branches. So the trick, of course, to find the vital spot, like we talked about in using that kind of terminology in the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, to find the vital spot to cut all of the delusions, all the myriad delusions, is to cut the root of them, which is ignorance grasping to self, so self-grasping, and to self of phenomena. So basically you could say grasping, self-grasping to self, to persons and phenomena, and its seeds are the, along with all of the other delusions and their seeds, are the all the obstructions to liberation. Okay?
So imprints are only after...
The word imprint that we translate as... I'm sorry?
What's the difference between...
I'm going to say. The thing that we translate as imprints, you could translate as latency. Sometimes people do translate as latency, or what else do they translate as, something like that. That is, the Tibetan word is bakcha. And that is something that is said to be present even when the delusions and their seeds are removed. There's still some subtle, subtle result of their having been present in our mind until it's removed. Like that's like what Rinpoche referred to as the smell of the garlic or the odor of the. He didn't use this example, but it's often used, like the what do we call mothballs? With the, nowadays they're naphthalene. What do they used to use? Camphor and other things to keep the moths out of the woolens in the winter. So even when you take out the gross camphor or the whatever, you clean the box, still there's something sort of that has been, you know, got deep into it and it's hard to get out. That's not called a seed, that's not called the afflictions, but it's the imprints of those. Those are not obstructions to liberation. Those are obstructions to omniscience or to all-knowing. Actually, the word we translate is omniscient, so it's, in a sense, it's knowing all. So we can translate that as omniscience, right? There's not an exact word for omniscience, but all knowing or knowing all objects of knowledge. So the crux of the argument was talking about this. In order to achieve enlightenment, well, let me just check here. Carl's been studying well. Okay. Why not? You don't want me to say anymore. Okay.
When you have reached arhatship, your seeds are gone.
If you've achieved Hinayana arhatship and you haven't gone any further, the delusions have been abandoned, and the seeds of the delusions have been abandoned, but the imprints of the delusions have not been abandoned because you don't have the method yet to eliminate those. So I'm going to ask Carl a question. It said that the shadip are necessary, these obstructions to omniscience are necessary to achieve Buddhahood or omniscience. So can I just forget about abandoning the afflictive obscurations and only abandon the obstructions to omniscience? If I want to become Buddha, and just like that, the other stuff is like kindergarten, and I just go for the, you know.
Sounds like if you're getting the cart before the horse, that you couldn't flip that process around.
So, to achieve Buddhahood, you do have to eliminate the afflictive obscurations.
Right.
Okay, so you have to eliminate both.
Yeah.
To attain arhatship, you can just eliminate one. It's not possible to only eliminate the knowledge obscurations, because according to the highest philosophical school, the subtlemost form of them, these imprints that are the shadip, they're not abandoned until you reach the so-called pure bhumis, the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis. So the question that arose, so who was asking? Venerable, you were asking that question? Yeah. The question that arose in class revolved around some comments Rinpoche was making in enumerating some of these practices, I believe, of the Bodhisattvas or one of the other practices, and that was in regard to these knowledge obscurations. Rinpoche made a comment about there being different kinds of knowledge obscurations, some of which were imprints and some of which were the nature of consciousness. So what Venerable Pemmo is referring to is that often what we hear in a certain enumeration of the teaching, certain presentation, is that the knowledge obstructions, or the obstructions to all-knowing or omniscience, are only imprints, like the smell of the garlic or the smell of the camphor. But there are other kinds of knowledge obstructions that are minds. So in the class, Rinpoche was asked, what was an example of those? So, does anyone remember? Maureen, were you paying attention?
Well, I remember this, I remember the discussion, but I put it back together.
Who's really a...
So,
Rinpoche said there are two kinds of obstruction to omniscience. One of which is an imprint. So, very subtle stain on the mind. And those are often what some of us have come to think of as the main kind of knowledge obscuration. Some of us, you know, if we haven't studied, we may not have encountered anything else. But Rinpoche said there's another kind of knowledge obscuration, which is of the nature of consciousness. So that goes back to say, what is an imprint, these imprints that are being eliminated from the mind? What are they? Of the various categories of phenomena, let's say they might be, because they're impermanent, because they can be eliminated, right? They could either be material, matter, or they can be consciousness. Those are both impermanent. What else could they be if they're impermanent?
Okay.
Do you know, Janet? Have you heard? There's a third category of impermanent things, permanent phenomena. Pardon?
Perception.
That's consciousness. It's called what we know the Tibetan name, Demenduchi, or non-associated compositional factors. So those of you who've studied a little bit about the five aggregates, you know, one of the aggregates is called compositional factors. Is this one here? Because I think this one's the form aggregate, because it's off by itself, right? These four are consciousness. There's feeling and discrimination, then compositional factors, and then what's the fifth one? Meaning primary consciousness, right? Because all the others are consciousness in a sense. So compositional factors includes many different things. In general, compositional factors, some compositional factors are minds. But there are some compositional factors that are not associated with consciousness. And those are called non-associated compositional factors. and such things as time is a non-associated compositional factor. The idea of a person is a non-associated compositional factor. Like Truman Lai is a non-associated compositional factor. Why? Because Truman is a person and impermanent, but Truman is not consciousness. Truman is not form. In fact, it's another category. Person is a category of phenomena which is impermanent, which is labeled onto a combination of consciousness and form. In fact, Rinpoche has been talking about that quite a few times when he was talking about the formless realm and other things, right? So there are other kinds of non-associated compositional factors. One other kind of thing is the imprints in the mind are non-associated compositional factors. They're not consciousness itself. They're not matter. They're not material. They're not made of atoms. Yet they are impermanent. And so there is, besides the imprints, there's another kind of obstruction to omniscience. So that what Rinpoche said, the crux of it is that the example of the consciousness awareness, which is a obstruction to omniscience, is this. You have to sort of understand, first of all, that when we talk about self-grasping, let's say grasping to true existence, that is what, a main mind or a mental factor? The root of samsara. What kind of mind is that? The affliction.
The mental factor.
It's a mental factor. Do you know the difference between the main mind and the mental factor, Venerable? So the main mind means the nature of a particular consciousness, whether it be an eye consciousness or an ear consciousness or the mental consciousness, just its bare ability to know the entity of its object. It's kind of what's called the, in a certain working sense, that's called bare conscious. What's the word I'm missing here? What's it called? Primary consciousness. Sosem. In any particular consciousness, though, all of its ability to experience qualities of the perceptual field are not called primary consciousness. They're called mental factors, that which arises from the mind. We say semjung. So main mind is called chitta. You know chitta. Like, I don't mean the animal in India or wherever they live. I don't mean the next operating system for the Mac after Panther. I mean chitta, C-I-T-T-A or C-H-I-T-T-A. Chitta is a Sanskrit word like bodhicitta. That means main mind. Secondary mind, or that which arises within the mind, like within the ocean of the mind, the waves and all of the other kinds of turbulence within it, or its qualities are called that which arises from the mind, chaita, instead of chitta. So the root of samsara is a particular kind of distorted wisdom within our consciousness that we call ignorance. Ignorance, from a higher point of view, doesn't mean, the really worst kind of ignorance is not just not knowing something. You know, I didn't know it was Friday. Oh wait, it's Thursday, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was that. Now, I'm not talking about that kind of ignorance. Not knowing Microsoft Word or not knowing you know, your ABCs or the president. That's not so detrimental. In a deeper sense, there is a kind of meaning of ignorance in not understanding the law of cause and effect, but that's not the fundamental ignorance. That is a kind of ignorance that contributes to our creating negative karma, right? But that's not called the fundamental ignorance. The root of samsara, the main kind of ignorance, is actually a distorted kind of wisdom that we call ignorance, marikpa or avidya. Vidya means knowing, avidya means not knowing, and which actually is looking the wrong way at things. Like, for instance, it's a mental factor, it's kind of a wisdom, which is, or a misdirected wisdom, or view that is perceiving, observing the self-identity that appears to our consciousness and believing it's real, sort of, in a sense, grasping to it. That's why it's called self-grasping, ignorance. Or looking at outer phenomena, the outer world, and believing that it actually exists the way that it appears as somehow findable, existing from its own side. Those are mental. That's all a mental factor. Something similar to wisdom, but a distorted wisdom within our consciousness that is called ignorance. That's the fundamental thing. So let's take the tabletop as the main mind, and this is that kind of we call dakshin, self-grasping ignorance, mental factor that's within the mind. Even though this is the main root, this is the actual. In fact, this is not a shedrip, is it? This is what? This is what we call the afflictive obscuration. This is the root afflictive obscuration, the root of them, this one. You thought it was a piece of paper. This is the root of all our problems. This is the self-grasping ignorance within our mind. That's not a shedrip, right? That's not a knowledge obscuration. That's an obscuration that has to be illuminated to achieve arhatship, along with its seed, some kind of some sort of potential with our mind that causes the continuity of that ignorance to rise. Even in this mind, when that's present, the whole mind takes on the quality of that. The whole mind could be said to be self-grasping, even though it's not self-grasping by its own power. Some of you who took the examination in Lurig, one of the questions I asked about the definition of doubt. I don't think anyone got the definition right in the whole class, because everyone left out at least that phrase, by its own power. Do you remember this? Doubt was two-pointed mind, which is two-pointed by its own power, because according to those tenets, a doubting mind, you know, the whole mind, the whole primary consciousness could be called doubt also. But this was only referring to the mental factor, doubt. Okay, so let's say this self-grasping that's in the mind, the whole mind takes on the same kind of vibration of that, the same aura of that. It all has the tendency of being grasping, along with the other mental factors, which are its partners, its concomitants in that primary mind. It sounds like the great scholars of the past. You remember the discussion between, who was it, Nagasena and the king. You know this story? Nagasena was a great Buddhist monk that I think the story is that in a previous life he had been a monk, and there was a young monk with him, and he was always asking questions of the older monk, and I can't remember exactly how. I think he said he would try to answer his questions. I can't remember. They developed some kind of karmic connection about answering questions, and in a future life the older monk, the scholar, was born as a monk, born as a boy in India, became a monk, and the young boy was a representative of the king of Greece, I think, wasn't it? Do you know? Anyone know? So anyway, it was up in like Kashmir or Afghanistan. This was several hundred years after Buddha, and it's part of the Hinayana collected teachings, the questions of, I think it was called King Melinda. So he was a local king, but he was kind of a representative of the Greece or one of those countries. And so he would, when the king was very eager to have sort of partners to debate with, because he was very intelligent, and so he was always asking the local philosophers and scholars and the religious people to be brought to him, and he'd usually defeat them because he was very clever. He'd defeat, not in battle, but in debate. But when he heard about Nagasena, something sort of special, because he had a karmic connection with him, rose in his mind, and he wanted him to come and there the discourse between them is always like, give an later, there, I was just thinking when you said, give an example, you just blurted out. The awful time, Nagasena would say something, answer one question, and then King Melinda would immediately say, oh, give an example, So this is what I blurted out to Rinpoche the other day too, also when he talked about this. So this is the example that he gave. The dansen itself, the self-grasping, that's a mental factor, and that is not a shedip. That's not a knowledge obscuration. That's an obstruction to liberation or an afflicted obscuration. But the minds that are present with it, the other mental factors like feeling, discrimination, the so-called omnipresent mental factors will always be present with that, and maybe some other kinds of mental factors. There might be, there's some, you have to check, if you could say, whether attachment is present in the same mind or not. But anyway, might be in another stream of consciousness, there's attachment. Might be some other kinds of mental factors present in their mind. All of those are self-grasping, but they are not the affliction of self-grasping, which is this one. This is what has to be removed, pulled out from the mind. But all of these have to be, the whole tenor of the mind is, in a sense, also has to be abandoned, but it is not called, and for a reason I don't know, it is not called an afflictive obscuration. The rest of the mind that takes on that quality, it is called a knowledge obscuration, which is the quality of, has the nature of consciousness. So I believe that's what Rinpoche was talking about at that point. So I'll just mention a few things and then ask if you have some more questions. Just so you get a little idea, or that I get a little idea that I know what I'm saying here. The text has been basically, one of the very first stanzas of the text introduces the topic matter of the text, which is what? Do you know, Pat? Look up at me. What's the topic matter of the text? What's the essence, in summary, what?
Sublime continuum.
Okay. Don, what do you think? No. What's the essential topics of the text? Seven Vajra-like points that summarizes all of the meanings of the text, right? So, they constitute several chapters, right? So the first chapter talked about the first four Vajra-like points. Then Rinpoche mentioned there's a chapter on enlightenment, and then a second chapter on enlightenment, a third chapter on what? The qualities, or yonden. Then a fourth chapter on enlightened activity. And then what? You don't know what? What the benefits, or something like that, right? There's the first chapter has four Vajra-like points, 5, 6, 7, and then a fifth chapter which is talking about qualities, the benefits, and so forth. So we're only talking about the first chapter, first of all, and of that, we've only begun to talk about the seven Vajra-like points, leaving in, I think, some very strong imprints, if you want, positive imprints, not shedip, things that have to be abandoned from our mind. Leaving very strong imprints in our mind to understand this text because of Rinpoche's kindness and just presenting exactly, things to fill in details in our mind. So the very next stanza in the text was, one of the stanzas here is talking about how the seven Vajra-like categories are taught in sutra. So that is what Rinpoche, even though that's skipped over very, very quickly usually, Rinpoche has spent much of the time in the discourses talking about on your page 2, outline 1.2, right? How the seven Vajra-like categories are taught in sutra. So these are taught in accordance with the order of the relation of specific characteristics in the sutra requested by King, here it says King Ishvara, the actual text I have says King Dharani. I think his name is Dharani Ishvara. So I'm not sure why he put Ishvara there. In some other commentaries it calls him Ishvara. It doesn't mean the god Ishvara. So In that this particular sutra, the sutra requested by Dharani Ishvara, the king of Dharani Ishvara, there are, in the introduction to that text, the first three categories that Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are taught. Remember Shay talked about this. And then the four remaining, including potential, are taught in the classification of bodhisattvas and the qualities or the dharmas of the conquerors. Conquerors meaning what? The Buddhas, right? It's an epithet for that. So in this context, we had some little sheets that we wrote up to just try to give some other information. So on one of them, it had, in talking, it said, when Rinpoche actually was reading the commentary, which is not only, this information doesn't come just from Lama Tsongkhapa's disciple Kedrubche, right? This commentary, was the commentary written by, no, Gelsubche rather. The commentary is written by Gelsubche. This information doesn't come just from him. He's actually commenting on the commentary to Uttara Tantra by Asanga himself. The Sangha, remember Asanga went up to where? Heaven of 33? Where did he go? Victoria, you know where? He went to Tushita, heaven, with Maitreya, received the five texts, one of which was Uttara Tantra, and when he came back to Earth, he wrote commentaries of his own, depending on his own understanding of them. Maybe he had some nice nuggets from Maitreya. You know, he was up there with Maitreya for several days, so he must have understood what the texts were about. He probably had some teachings. So he wrote commentaries, and Asanga's commentary is quite difficult, I understand, relatively difficult. That's why the great scholars of the different Tibetan traditions wrote their own commentaries, not so much directly commenting, I mean, in a sense commenting, the main thing they're commenting on is Uttara Tantra, but they're also commenting on it through commenting on Asanga's commentary. Does that make sense?
Asanga writes, he's the only one who wrote the Uttara Tantra, though. He wrote the Uttara Tantra and the commentary? I mean, put it in writing.
I guess you could kind of say he was the scribe. Did anyone, you remember Little Abner?
Yeah.
Writ by me.
He
wrote it down. I wouldn't say he wrote it. If you say he wrote it, no. It sounds like he was the author. Put it in writing or memory and passed it on to others. I don't know if it was immediately written down, but he composed commentary to it. And so this kind of detail about which parts of the sutra refer to these various things comes basically from Asanga's commentary. So if you read Chinese, you can read, these things probably exist in Chinese. I don't know how good all of you ladies are in classical Chinese. Can you read the scriptural Chinese? So this is something, you have a great advantage because you could go back and read those texts and maybe there's some more recent commentaries and see when you study this again, you can kind of embellish it with that because I'm sure it exists in the Chinese tradition. So in talking about the first three Vajra points were talked about in the introduction to that sutra requested by King Dharani Ishvara. The fourth point is indicated by certain words, by certain things. What's the fourth point?
Potential.
And it's indicated by what? Sort of indirectly. This was had to be pointed out by Maitreya to Asanga. He said, okay, this point, this is where Buddha's actually, what he's talking about is potential. Because why it's indicating potential is because he's talking about the 60 types of activities or qualities that totally purify the Buddha potential. Right? Remember what those 60 qualities were? Our very kind translator went over, like a true scientist, many times, enumerating them, adding them. What were they? 20? How many were they? There were 60 altogether. What were they?
4,
8, and 16, and 32, right? Four ornaments of bodhicitta. Of the bodhisattvas, rather, the 16 types of the 8 illuminations of the Bodhisattvas, thank you, 16 types of great compassion of the Bodhisattvas, to be distinguished from the compassion of the Buddhas that comes later, and the 32 types of Bodhisattva action. Okay? Those were in the text, in this sutra requested by King Dharaniyashvara. In the section about Bodhisattvas, it's talking about these different kind of things, and the implication that Maitreya was able to point out was that this is talking about, really what it's talking about is potential, because to the reason the Bodhisattvas engage in these 60 kind of activities is to purify their Buddha potential, to become enlightened. So those activities then are sort of indicative, those are indicating, according to Maitreya's commentary, that's the source of the sutra that's talking about Buddha potential. Then in talking about the next Vajra-like point, what comes next after that? Pardon? Qualities or enlightenment? Quality. No. Enlightenment comes first. No, not the quality. Enlightenment comes next. That may be wrong. You can't, because just because it's written. Huh? Okay. What comes next are, in fact, I've crossed out the words qualities. This is actually because the next Vajra point is enlightenment, before you talk about the qualities of enlightenment. And this is indicated, enlightenment itself is indicated by indicating the 16 types of compassions of a Buddha or of the Buddha. This is different than the how many types of great compassion of the Bodhisattvas were there, 16 types. So this is a different list, right? So this is what Rinpoche went over particularly yesterday, that and might be worth going over a little bit. The list that I had just prepared for people, you could see I had left one of the numbers out, and somehow we got even again later because two of them had to be put together again. So let's go through that. If you still have this old list, if you haven't corrected it, you follow what I'm talking about?
No.
Didn't pardon me? Take out the words, the qualities of are in parentheses, right?
Uh-huh.
That was an attempt on my part to make sense of it at the early point in when I made the outline. But that this is actually talking about the words in the sutra which indicate the Vajra point of enlightenment. Okay? So this is just enlightenment. Got it? So, because we already talked about the parts in the sutra that indicated Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that was in the introduction. Then the part that indicated potential, it were the 60 purifying qualities, right? The Bodhisattvas. Now, what indicates enlightenment are these 16 types of compassion of the Buddha. And it's not just like talking about compassion for the poor. Like earlier, these kinds of great compassion of the Bodhisattva, we're talking about actually the objects of their compassion, right? Joining those who have fallen into the four rivers or the four waters, joining those not delighting in advice to delight in advice and so forth. Compassion for particular kinds of suffering that people were undergoing, not the ordinary kind of physical suffering, but obstacles that they had, which were really great impediments to their practice. But here, almost all of these are talking about different kinds of emptiness, different ways of talking about emptiness. So what was the point? How did that have to do with compassion? Compassion is really part of the method side, right? And emptiness is realized by wisdom. So what did Rinpoche explain? Do you remember? Who can explain?
They complement each other.
How's that?
Well, the more wisdom you have, the more specific is your compassion, the more clever is your compassion. And the more compassion you have, the more you like
to have. Okay, now wait a second. I'll debate with you. Is that okay? Because in the Nyingma tradition, there's a... I know there's a in the Western presentation of it sometimes, they say, oh, there's no special need to put so much emphasis to develop compassion, some people say. This may not be what the great lamas say, but some people say, explain it like this. Because when you realize emptiness, compassion naturally arises. Now, I'm sort of reading into, this is what in Buddhist philosophy is called pushing. Pushing, you know, trying to draw out some implication from your question that you might not have intended. Do you see what I'm saying? The implication is that if someone, a great saint, were to develop more wisdom, their compassion would necessarily increase. I think that's only true if there's already a development of compassion. Then that wisdom helps to make that compassion more useful, more profound. But here, what was the reason that it was? Was it from that sense that these were talking about enlightenment? These 16 compassions? Look at the last couple of lines after the 16th point. What does it say? Yeah, having observed sentient beings who have not attained those 16 and who have not realized the meaning of the natural state of great enlightenment. So this is actually talking about, is it Sigrid or Ingrid?
It's Sigrid.
Sigrid. This is talking about a little bit, just a little bit similar to what you're saying, a little bit another side of it is that observing sentient beings, not with these other kinds of problems, but those who don't realize emptiness in all its totality, that the way that the Buddha realizes emptiness, so he has a kind of compassion that other people can't have because they haven't realized ultimate reality as he has. Do you follow what I'm saying? That's kind of one of these special qualities, this kind of compassion of the Buddha. Even the Bodhisattvas don't have, because how could they feel compassion for people who lack a certain realization when they themselves don't have that realization? They don't quite understand what, you know, so what? They don't realize that emptiness, you know. They don't quite feel the urgency. So this is what these compassions were talked about. Let me throw it back in your corner. I don't know if you want to go through the list, or maybe you want to ask some particular questions, either about these or others. Dan, do you have any? Chris, way over there. Can you read in the dark over there?
Sure.
Yeah.
You asked me a question,
I was asking if anyone had any questions, such as Chris. That was my question to you. And he asked if I was asking a question. It's good. Are you asking a question? Are you asking me a question? That's a question. You have a question? Okay. Okay. It's like Abbott and Costello.